We finished chapter 2 last week. I want to go back to just the end of chapter 2 to set the stage for chapter 3. In chapter 3, we actually begin the rebuilding of the wall in the book of Nehemiah. But chapter 2, at the end of that book, we see Nehemiah throughout chapter 2 setting the stage for the work that needs to be done, getting the permissions that he needs to, traveling all the way to Jerusalem from the palace area, about a three-month journey that he had to make, dealing with opposition as he did that, and then scoping out the whole situation late at night, taking just a few trusted people with him, going around the walls, finding out what the work was that really needed to be done. And then we get to verse 18, and that's where we want to take a look for just a moment to jump into chapter 3. Verse 18 of chapter 2 says, "And I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also of the words that the king had spoken to me." Now, why would Nehemiah, after checking out all that needed to be done with the wall and looking at all the work that needed to be done, why do you suppose he took the time in verse 18 to share with the leaders, to share with other of the officials there? If you look in verse 16, he's probably talking to the officials, the priests, the nobles, all of those who, anybody who had anything to do with getting anything done in Jerusalem, he gets together. And the first thing he does is shares with them basically a testimony. What was the purpose, do you think, in that? Why would he start that way before getting into the work?
I think he was a good diplomat. He was being sure the king didn't feel like he was being run over.
Okay, there's probably some diplomatic politics going on there. Why else do you think he did that? Yeah, John.
There would have been a lot of fear, perhaps, or uncertainty. I mean, otherwise they would have already built these walls a long time ago. But there's this this boding sense of, I don't know if we can do this. And he's testifying, God is doing this. We can do it to strengthen them.
Yeah, whose burden was this whole building of the wall at this point?
Nehemiah's.
It was Nehemiah's burden. Was Nehemiah going to be able to build the wall all by himself? You know, and so Nehemiah goes to the key people there with a testimony of the fact that God's hand is upon this. And again, we covered a lot of stuff last week. But why was that so necessary for those workers? Jonathan said if they had the gumption to do it, they already would have started building the wall themselves. Why weren't they? Okay, they may have needed encouragement.
Enemies
were keeping them from doing that. You remember what we talked about 13 years prior to Nehemiah doing this? Had they already attempted this once? Yeah, they attempted to build the wall once, and what happened? Kind of tying in with George's comment.
They stopped.
They were stopped. Now, why did they stop?
Because of the king.
Okay, so the enemies in the area around Jerusalem sent this memo to the king, and Ezra actually records the memo for us, basically saying, King, just a reminder for you, you know, a friendly reminder from people who are looking out for your good, which was as a lie as a lie can be. They were looking out for their own good. They said, now looking out for your good, you need to look back into the annals here and see what kind of a reputation the folks in Jerusalem have. Because these folks are troublemakers. They're a thorn in your flesh. They do not want you ruling over them. And was there truth in some of what they had shared with the king?
Yes.
Did the Jews want King Artaxerxes ruling over them? Did they want to be sending tribute to Artaxerxes? Who did they consider to be their king? Ultimately, God. Now, they had human kings as well by this time, but they felt like they should be serving God, and instead Artaxerxes is telling them what to do, and they're rebelling against them. And how did Jerusalem end up in the mess it was in the first place? The walls have been torn down. How did that happen? Was that just over time? Is it like our houses where if we don't repair them, things keep falling apart? You know, how did the walls end up where they were? Because of their disobedience. When and how did it happen?
Babylonians.
Thank you. The Babylonians came because they did the same thing to Nebuchadnezzar. They were a thorn in his flesh. And when Nebuchadnezzar had had enough, he came to Jerusalem and they tore down the walls. They tore down the temple. Why would they tear the temple down, by the way? This all fits into all that's going on here in the time of Nehemiah. Why would they tear their temple down? Where was the temple? On the Temple Mount. Why is that important when you approach Jerusalem? Where was the high ground in Jerusalem? If all else failed and they were fighting a foe, where would they finally retreat to? The Temple Mount. We think, if you think of the temple like you think of Bethany Bible Church, you're missing it. I mean, the temple was grand and glorious in Solomon's day, but it was also a fortress. And they would, that would be the last line of defense. So Nebuchadnezzar comes through. He ends up tearing down the walls and tearing down their temple, their last fortress of defense, and leaving the whole place in ruins. And so the people knew all this. And when they finally came back under the Persians, the Medes and the Persians, they were able to bring a group back and started building the walls. Their enemies in the area thought, well, what do we need a strong Jerusalem for? They're nothing but a threat. So they sent back to Artaxerxes and said, you don't want them doing this. They won't send you tribute. You're going to have a mess from over here. And the region was called Beyond the River because it was the other side of the Euphrates from where the palace and things were. And so it said, beyond the river, you're going to have nothing but a mess if you allow them to rebuild the wall. So Artaxerxes just said what? No more wall. Let's stop building the wall, because why would I want to allow you to do this to my hurt? 13 years prior to this. Now, that is probably the last word until Nehemiah gets there that all these folks have had. The king said, no, here comes this guy Nehemiah. How renowned would Nehemiah have been in all of Jerusalem?
Probably not very much.
Yeah, I don't think when he started, I mean, we look back and we think Nehemiah, and he's one of the great leaders of the Old Testament. But up until the time that Nehemiah shows up in Jerusalem, what's his position there in Jerusalem? He's the king's cupbearer, which resides where? In the palace. And it's 3 months' journey from Jerusalem. So how much clout does he really have in Jerusalem? He comes, he's got a great idea, but it's kind of like, you remember Moses? When God said to go to the people, and they said, well, when the people ask who I am, what am I going to tell them? Because who am I? Well, here comes Nehemiah. And so we get to verse 18, and if we're not careful, we slide right past it. But verse 18 is critical to chapter 3. Because Nehemiah is telling them, and I told them of the hand of Artaxerxes upon me and how good he'd been to my requests. Is that what the verse says? Yeah, isn't that interesting the way he put it? Who gave him safe passage to come to Jerusalem from the palace? Yeah, the king, but it was God. And so what Nehemiah is saying is, look, King Artaxerxes has given me free passage. King Artaxerxes is going to provide the timber for your gates to be reconstructed. And what are they thinking? Yeah, wait a minute. Isn't this the guy who said no more walls? And you're telling me that Artaxerxes is going to provide the timber so we can build the gates to shut him out? And not only that, he's saying, and I've been sent with his blessing to put this wall. And here's letters to all of these enemies that wrote this memo to the king years ago saying, you need to cooperate with this guy. And in the midst of that, he doesn't say, I did this. He doesn't say, Artaxerxes did this. He says in the beginning in verse 18, and I told him of the hand of God that had been upon me for good, and also of the words that the king had spoken to me. Isn't that interesting the way he put that? He told him how the hand of God had been upon him, and also almost like a sidelight. Oh, and by the way, I also told him about the fact that the king said this was okay. But the king isn't the focal point of verse 18. It's God. So now that he's focused their eyes on God and the project that needed to be done and the vision that he had, then they said to him, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. How did he get from discouraged workers who wanted nothing to do with this huge project anymore that the king had shut down to them all rising up and saying, let who rise up? Let us rise up and build. What happened? They did. How did they get there?
They read their They read the
devotional that day. I don't see that in there. Okay. Larry's been like these evangelists that kind of read some great stuff into the passage that's not there. But, you know, but in a way, he's somewhat right. What put them from the fact of being depressed, discouraged, and apathetic toward the work of the wall? The wall had been sitting and crumble and rumble and just laying there for 13 years and more. 13 years since they tried to put it back together. So what got them to the point where they said, let us rise up and build? Because what was the danger as Nehemiah arrived into Jerusalem? You have apathetic people who look at Nehemiah, and Nehemiah said, God's given me a vision, and I think we need to do this, and I want to see this wall built. And what do apathetic people normally say?
It never happened,
and then, oh, well, go ahead and do it. And now, was Nehemiah going to accomplish it if they all looked at him and said, that's fine, you go ahead and do it. You know, you've got the lumber coming in. You know, you've got all the permissions, so go ahead and do it. Was that going to work? So how did we get from Nehemiah's vision to let us rise up and build?
They knew their history. They knew how that God had delivered them from Egypt in the past.
It is their history.
It was bathed in prayer.
Nehemiah had bathed it in prayer.
God's will.
Yeah, and they got a vision of what God wanted done. And I think that's why I wanted, before we got into chapter 3, because chapter 3 is a lot of detail. And we're not going to spend a lot of time reading all those names. I'll be honest, I stumbled over all these names all week. I tried to look up how to pronounce some of these names, and I'm still going to slaughter some of these names if I'm not careful, because they're not normal names that we go through. But it's a whole list of names of people that followed through on verse 18, let us rise up and build, and they strengthened their hands for the good work. And God got a hold of their hearts. And can I say, if anything's going to be done even here at Bethany Bible Church, God's got to get a hold of our hearts. You know, you can preach from the pulpit, you can teach it from Sunday school, I can get all excited and jump up and down, but you know what's going to be accomplished in the end if God doesn't get a hold of all of our hearts to do something? Nothing. The same thing that would have been accomplished in Jerusalem. So there's some interesting things we can pull out of this as we go through this study, because what Nehemiah gets from the beginning of verse 2 to the beginning of chapter 3, between chapters, is wall-to-wall workers. Suddenly, Nehemiah goes from it's me and my version, my vision, to what? What happens as we start chapter 3? What's going on in all of chapter 3? Take a glance at it. What's happening in chapter 3? Yeah, they're getting ready to build. What else?
I said the same thing. They started building.
Yeah, they all were getting assignments, and they were all starting to build. Now, there's an excitement that goes with that, but what else goes with that?
Vision.
Vision has to be a part of that, because it's all exciting the first day you do it, but about day 3 or 4, what sets in? Reality sets in, and they find out this is hard work. Do we really have a vision for that? What else happens when you get this many people together doing a job?
Disagreement, probably.
You think there's disagreement when you get that many people together? They all had the same vision, didn't they? They all said, let us rise up and build, and they were ready to go. Why would there be disagreement?
They're human.
Yeah, they're human. And why do humans disagree? Now, how many of you ever disagree with someone? No, we all disagree with somebody sometimes. Why does that happen?
Different ideas and opinions.
You ever get two men together doing the same project building? Do they ever have different ideas and opinions? I have two dear friends. I won't give you their names. They'd give you their names if they were here. But I have two dear friends that I used to do a lot of projects with down in Anderson, and they were both guys that liked to build and liked to do things. And I like to build with one of them, or I'd like to work with the other one, but working with the two of them together was a nightmare, because when they got together, they would look at the same project, but invariably there were two different ways to do that, and they both decided to go a different way. And so there were 3 or 4 of us that would work together in a group, and when those two showed up, the other two of us would grab a cup of coffee, sit back and chuckle while they debated for about an hour on how to do it and finally came to an agreement. And I thought, now multiply that by all the people you see in chapter 3. This is a miracle of God that he puts this whole thing together, and that Nehemiah, who's not a construction engineer, who's not a contractor, so he's not used to putting all these people together, puts this all together with the vision that God has given him, and we see some exciting things happening. And again, the reason for that is the first thing I wanted to look at as we go through chapter 3 is the purpose of the work. As they got together to do this building, what was the purpose of it? When they cried out in chapter 2, verse 18, "Let us rise up and build," why did they say, "Let us rise up and build"? What was driving that? You could say God, but there's something specific about that that drove it. Look at the end of verse 17. Yeah, they didn't want to be a reproach. Now, again, you've got to think about what they're saying and where they're saying it. What was the thing that was becoming a reproach to the people?
It didn't glorify God.
Yeah, and that's what I wrote. Nehemiah's concern and the concern of the people when they said, "Let us rise up and build," was the fact that the glory of God was no longer being seen in Jerusalem. Why was that important to them? Did the Gentiles around them know how important it was for them to glorify God? It's like now, you think about it nowadays. I could ask the question differently and put it in a modern context. Do your neighbors know what a Christian's supposed to look like and do?
Yes.
They've at least got a pretty good idea. Now, they may be over the top on some of their ideas, but sometimes do they know better than we do what a Christian's supposed to be doing? You know, you step out of line as a Christian, and who's one of the first people that'll let you know that, "I didn't think Christians did that"? You know, and it happens, and you've got all of these Gentile nations around them, and look forward to Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 9, because Nehemiah is going to build on this idea later, but it says in Nehemiah 5, 9, "So I said, the thing that you are doing is not good. Ought you not to walk in the fear of our God to prevent the taunts of the nations of our enemies?" So, Jerusalem is a special city. We're going to look at a couple verses in just a second on that. But the enemies of God were doing what to the people of God and to God himself because of the condition Jerusalem was in? According to Nehemiah 5:9.
Taunting.
You ever been around junior hires? They can taunt like nobody's business. What does taunting mean?
Mocking.
Yeah, mocking. So here we have this city that's supposed to be the city of God in ruins, and all of the Gentile nations around them are mocking God and mocking the Jewish people because look at the city that's supposed to be the city of God. Now, where did they get that from? Look over at Psalm chapter 48, verse 2. Actually, we could start at verse 1, but turn over to Psalm 48. Just to kind of get an idea of why this project is so important as they get started and they rise up and build. Psalm chapter 48, if I can find that one. There it is, after 47. 48, "Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised." That's how that psalm starts. So the psalm is focusing on what? Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised. What is it focusing on? Yeah, God's greatness, God's goodness, who God is. But what does it say right after that? "Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God." When the Jewish folks thought about praising God and glorifying God, what location did they invariably think about?
Jerusalem,
and specifically the temple in Jerusalem. And so here the psalmist is talking about here. It says, "Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God." And how does it describe that city? "His holy mountain, beautiful in elevation, is the joy of all the earth." Do you think that the Jewish people proclaimed that to the folks around them? Look at Jerusalem. Jerusalem is God's city. We are God's people. Did God intend for that to be? Yeah, just like Matthew chapter 5, where we are told we are the light of the world, throughout the Old Testament, where were people supposed to see the glory of God being exhibited? Jerusalem. They would think of Jerusalem. So this city was special to them. Not only that, but turn over to Psalm chapter 87 and verse 2. Psalm 87 and verse 2. And again, back up to verse 1, the psalmist begins, "On the holy mount stands the city he founded." What holy mount is that? Yeah, it's the Mount Zion that the Jerusalem is built on. And he goes on further and he says here, "The Lord loves the gates of
Zion."
What gates are those? I know there's a figurative sense to this, but specifically when they thought of it, what gates were they thinking of? Yeah, the gates around the temple in the city of Jerusalem. And what did those gates look like right now? Now again, do you think they proclaimed to the Gentiles around them that the Lord loves the gates of Jerusalem? The Lord loves the gates around our temple? The Lord works on our behalf? So all this has gone out, and even to the point where we see that now that they're holding them in derision. So God's glory is what's at stake. So as we look at the purpose of the work here, the first thing there is God's glory is at stake in all this. Secondly, the purpose of the ministry in this church, as we apply it, is what? Why do we do anything in the church here at Bethany Bible Church? Why should we be doing it?
To glorify God.
To glorify God. It's not just so that we grow and get more people. Is that a good goal? Growth in the church? It's not just so that we get along well and have a church that we enjoy coming to. Is that a good goal? I hope so. Is it not just that we can get together and minister to one another? Is that a good goal? You know, what did Paul say about us? We are a body with gifts. We're supposed to be ministering to one another. But what is the ultimate goal of the church? To glorify God. What's the ultimate goal of our lives? To glorify God. How do we know that? Where in the book? There you go. 1 Corinthians 10:30. And the reason I ask that is because I've been guilty so many years. I teach and I think about things and I say, it's in there. And somebody will ask me where, and then I start fumbling around because I can't remember where. And it's important to be able to go and put our finger on it. Put your finger on 1 Corinthians 10:31. Whether therefore you eat or drink or whatsoever you do, do all to the glory of God. That means if we meet together as a church, it ought to be for the glory of God. And if our church isn't functioning well, what does that say about the glory of God to this neighborhood?
Just another religion.
Yeah, it's nothing special. It says almost the same thing as Jerusalem being in rubble said to the people around Israel. He's just another little g God. Is that true? No, and that's why this project goes to the heart of the Jewish people, and they say, let us rise up and build. Did I see a hand?
We have the same problem that they had. It's called lethargy. And I think that's one of Satan's greatest tools. But just a little brief history here. Mm-hmm. Nebuchadnezzar tore down the temple. Why? It was the symbol of the greatness of their God. And just think of all the miracles that God did up to this point. How come the people weren't remembering that he opened the Red Sea? How come they weren't remembering all these things that he did? And that temple was a key symbol of the glory of God. Mm-hmm. That's why it was torn down. And this is why part of the people, yeah, we tried it before and it didn't work. They're full of lethargy. And I think many Christians today are in the same boat. We've got a world to reach out there, but do we really care? No, I'm taking care of my own problems first, you know?
And that's exactly what it is. The more I study this book, the more I get challenged by the fact that there are a lot of principles that we need to pull out of this book to apply to our lives today, because we can get the same way. And even when we think about evangelism as a group and as a church, you ever evangelize and not see results? And what does that do? I know what it does to me. What does that do to you? Yes, discouraging. I think I shared with somebody this morning, and this is the last time I'm going to, I'm at 10 for this to be the last time. I can't promise, but I might slip out again another time. But I told Jordan this week. Jordan came home to me and said, my guys at the camp think I need to send my car in and take it to a mechanic. Now, I've been telling him that for a month. But when Dad said it, it didn't get through. But now he's finally gotten to the point where he's saying, my car's been sitting here since September, and he's gotten what? Somewhat discouraged. Now, I'm getting more discouraged because now he's borrowing my cars, and I can't get around like I want to get around. But at this point, he's not going to go work on it anymore because we put in all kinds of hours. We've done all kinds of things, and the car won't work, and you get discouraged. The people in Nehemiah's day were discouraged. If we're not careful, we can become lethargic and discouraged because we don't see things happening like we want to. And we need to go back to that whole purpose of, why are we here? We're here for the glory of God. Can I remind, we're not even here to have a church on this location. You know, sometimes we get to the point where we got to bring people in, otherwise our church is going to die. Is that true? If you don't bring people in, eventually what happens to your church? It dies. You know, that's not the most tragic thing that happens. The most tragic thing that happens is people look at a church that used to see God working and God was being glorified, and suddenly they look and they say, just like George said, that's just like all the other religions, because look what happened. And we need to be gathered together and working to grow as a church, to grow together to be more like Christ, to reach out with the gospel, because the glory of God is what's at stake, just like it was in Nehemiah's time. John chapter 17, verse 4, Jesus said in his high priestly prayer, I glorified you on the earth, having accomplished the work that you gave me to do. What was one of the ways that Jesus glorified God when he was here, according to that verse?
Obedience.
Yeah, I accomplished the work you gave me to do. How then are we supposed to glorify God? Because what is the point of this whole prayer in John chapter 17? Where is Jesus leading with all this when he gets in there? Who is he really praying for? There's 26 verses, I think, in that chapter. How many verses does he pray for himself? Anybody remember? I'm going to have to go back in my study again. There's about 5 verses when Jesus prays about his ministry. The next 21 verses, who's he praying for? Yeah, his followers, immediately his disciples, and then for us to come as we follow. And how are we going to glorify God then, according to part of that verse, chapter 17, verse 4? He said, I glorify God by doing the work you gave me to do, so we glorify God by doing? It's by doing the work that God's given us to do. And what is that work? Okay. Part of it is sharing Jesus Christ. And so that's how he gains glory, when we go out and share Jesus Christ with those that are around us, when we do the task that he's called us to do. How many of us is he called to be involved in the tasks that needs to be done?
All of us.
Look at Ephesians 2, verses 8 and 9. We love those two verses. Ephesians 2, 8 and 9. I'm getting bogged down here. I need to get moving. But Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 and 9. Somebody quote those for me. You probably know those verses.
For by grace are you saved through faith, not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast.
Is that where that passage stops? I mean, those are great verses. Those are wonderful salvation verses. For by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of your... It doesn't matter what I do. You know, I mean, it's not my works. It's the gift of God. And it's not of my works so that I can't boast. You mean I would boast if I had anything to do with my salvation? Yeah, I boast any time I do anything I think is worthwhile. That's part of our problem, pride. And God takes all that out and says, not of works lest any man should boast. But then what does he say in verse 10?
We are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus unto good works, which God hath before ordained that we should walk in them.
So he created us for what purpose? Works, to work, to do the work he's given us to do. And how does he put it at the end of that verse? Read that at the end of that verse again, Larry.
That he is before ordained that we should walk in them.
That we should walk in them. What is that word walking in there? What does it picture to you? Walking is a very active thing. Can you passively walk? We went to Myrtle Beach this week, and I love being at the beach in January. People say, why would you go there in January? You know why I love going there in January? Yeah, I open the door, I walk out on the beach. I don't have to worry what people are wearing. They're going to put clothes on at this time of the year. And I look up and down the beach, and it was wonderful. Wednesday was a miserable day. It was almost my favorite day at the beach. Because I walked out, and I looked 2 or 3 miles one way and 2 or 3 miles the other way. And you know what I saw? Nobody. The beach was mine. So my wife and I went walking on the beach. You know what the problem is with walking on the beach? I'm sitting here walking, and I'm talking, and the beach is flat, and the beach is fairly straight. And I lose track of time. So I put on my running app so I could keep track of how far we'd gone. And the one day I'm talking, I'm looking out, and I see this little turner point in the distance, and I thought, I've never gone there before. Let's go there. Let's go do that. And we walked out there, and I got to the point, and I looked back, and I couldn't see the building we were staying in. And the building we're staying in is 12 stories, to give you an idea. And I looked back, and I couldn't tell which one it was, and I thought, oh, this is not a good thing. And I got out my app, and you know what my app told me? We had walked 4 miles. That's enough for a whole day. So I thought, husbands, love your wives. Is Christ love the church? And I thought, can I ask my wife to go back and get the car and come back and get me? I thought, better of it, and didn't do that. But I had to walk all the way back. But as I was walking back, I was thinking of this whole passage, because we think of walking, and we don't think of the fact that it's work. And Paul says here that we were saved to do good works in order to walk in them. It's work. It's active. We need to be doing something for the Lord. And now I'm not telling you that we all ought to be chasing the toddlers and the elementary kids around. They had a youth activity here yesterday. And I came to the building, so I would be here as a presence. But I had college kids that were doing all these games, and they invited me to play games with them the last game they played, and I was glad it wasn't until the last game. Because I went home sore, and all we do is play ping pong baseball in the Awana room. But activity, work, what does God have for you to do? What are you doing to be a part? Because we're going to see here that it's because everybody pitches in, or almost everybody does, that the work ends up getting accomplished. So getting back on this, of course, you're building the walls, and the setting of the gates was for the glory of God. What was the other purpose for it? The number one purpose was the glory of God, but what was the other purpose? Were there any other purposes for building the wall? Yeah, it was for security. It was for protection. There were other good things that were being done, and again, I thought about that in the context of the church. It is good to have new people come into the church. It's exciting to build that way. It's exciting to bring kids into the church for kids programs. It's exciting to bring older folks into the church for older folks programs. But all that stuff, as good as it may be, even the security and the protection, the number one thing was God's glory. And for us in our lives, the number one thing has got to remain God's glory. So we get there, the purpose of the work. The second thing we see is the pattern of the work. Nehemiah was a world leader who planned his work and worked his plan. And the way he did it, it is an example for us to follow. Now again, I'm not going to read through all these names again in chapter 3 of Nehemiah. But if you read through these, you'll find that there are 38 different individuals that are named in this chapter. 38 individuals that worked, each with groups working with them. 42 different groups are identified. So you've got 38 people specifically mentioned. You've got 42 groups, and they're all working at the same time. Somebody coordinated that and made it work. Nehemiah, with his vision, coordinated it and planned it. But the thing is, all of those people were working. There were many workers, I'm sure, that Nehemiah did not name, because there's groups that he didn't even name the leader of their groups. And he goes on and he says here, Nehemiah didn't name them as important, but each worker, named and anonymous, is assigned a place and a task. And the work gets done. And again, you've got to picture what kind of work was being done here. What were they physically doing?
Lifting and building.
Yeah, they were building a wall. What did building a wall in Jerusalem entail? When I think about building a wall around my house, or building anything in my house, it's usually with wood and drywall and things I can maneuver with. When they built the wall in Jerusalem, what was their building material other than the timber for the gates? Stone. What kind of stones were they moving? Were they moving stones?
Heavy.
No, they were moving huge stones. What does that take? They went and got a bobcat and started moving them around, right?
Leopard.
Yeah, that takes leverage. That takes teamwork. That takes coordination. All of these things are going on as people are working together and people are pitching in. And everybody has to do their part when you're doing hard manual labor like that. And again, as I thought about it in conjunction with the church, I'm going to let D.L. Moody say it because I read this and I chuckled, but I thought, isn't that the way we often get? Even as George mentioned it, sometimes we get lethargic as we get to be church members. We kind of get happy with the way things are, content with the way things are. D.L. Moody, even in his time, said a great many people have a false idea about the church. They get an idea that the church is a place to rest in, to get into a nicely cushioned pew and contribute to the charities, to listen to the minister, and to do their share to keep the church out of bankruptcy is all they want. Is that possible to get into that kind of a mindset? I've been in churches, you know where their biggest concern was? The pews aren't very comfortable. And I can't tell you if these are very comfortable or not, because I stand up and I'm the one who makes them uncomfortable for you if I preach too long. But D.L. Moody's saying, even in his day, people get that idea of his church, and the last thing he said is very interesting. The idea for work for them, actual work in the church, never enters their mind. And again, there are folks here that I know are very, very busy in the church, but we get together as a body to glorify God, and how does that happen? How do we glorify God? Is it just by sitting in a cushioned pew? Now, being here is important, so don't take me wrong on that. Okay? Is it just listening to the message? Yeah, it's taking that, applying it to our lives, and doing the work that he's given us to do. And again, it's not necessarily the work that I've given you to do. But we need to be asking God for the vision of, what do you have for me to do? You know, and again, when do we get to stop doing that? You know, there's a day where we will enter into his rest. You know where we're going to reside then? Yeah, you'll be in heaven and your body will be 6 foot under, okay? Until then, God has something for us to do. Now, it may not be the same as for someone else, but there's something that we ought to be doing to be contributing to the cause of Christ. And that's the idea that we get as we look at this group. Another commentator, I like the way he put this, said, the group finished this task because they followed the same leader, kept their eyes on the same goal, and together worked for the glory of God. Because whenever you get working, invariably there's friction, things happen, and if you get your eyes off the goal and you get your mind off the thought of we're doing this for the glory of God, it's easy to get discouraged and set aside what we're trying to do. So that's how they got this work done and kept it going. Significant factors as we look at the pattern of the work here. The word built is used 6 times in Nehemiah, and it basically means to rebuild. How do we know that? Well, one is the way the word is used, but what were they doing with the wall? They were rebuilding. Were they making something totally brand new? No, and again, as a church, are we looking to make something totally brand new with our church? The pattern hasn't changed since Peter started in Jerusalem with all those 3,000 believers. But we need to be doing the work in order for the church to grow and in order for the church to be what it ought to be. A second word that comes up is to repair. It's used 35 times and it means to make strong and to make firm. And I like the idea that, again, Nehemiah wasn't interested in just a quick fix. He wasn't interested in kind of throwing something up there so everybody felt good. What was Nehemiah's goal? Yeah, he wanted a long-term wall that would stand to the glory of God. And so he worked toward those ends. And then it says, last term, bolts and bars are mentioned 5 times in Nehemiah. Nehemiah 3:6, and then 13 through 15. And again, the bolts and the bars were there for what purpose? What were the bolts and the bars? The bars, we know what they were. They laid across the gate. What were the bolts? You know, I just installed a bolt on my front door. I hit the code and the little bolt slides in. Is that what they had? Now, the bolts that they're talking about here, the word actually means the slots and all that have the mechanism in which those bars went so that the doors would be secure. Why was that so important? Why does it come up 5 or 6 times?
They still had enemies.
Yeah, they still had enemies. They needed to be secure as they built the wall. And again, as we work as a church, do we have enemies? And we need to put time into that as well. 2 John chapter 8 says, watch yourselves so that you may not lose what you've worked for many, but may win a full reward. And it's in the context of false teachers. We need to be regarding and aware of what's going on around us and guarding the truth just as they guarded Jerusalem there. So we get to that, and then the last thing, before we look at the gates for just a moment, are the people involved in the work. God uses all kinds of people. Chapter 3, verse 1, 12 through 19, he uses rulers and priests. Chapter 3, verse 12, if you look there, it just says men and women, just normal men and women who are willing to be used. Chapter 3, verse 18 and 32, professional craftsmen. Chapter 3, verses 2, 5, and 7, he used even people that were from outside the city. Foreigners came in and helped. There was a place for everyone and a job for them to do. Nehemiah and the leaders set the example as they went through. And then look at Nehemiah chapter 3 and verse 5. Nehemiah chapter 3, verse 5, and says, "And next to them the Tekoites repaired, but their nobles would not stoop to serve their Lord." So what does verse 5 tell us in chapter 3? You've got normal people working, you've got priests working, you've got princes working. Did everybody work?
That goes back to Sanballat and his buddy, because it goes back to chapter 18 where you start, verse 18 where you start. I think one of the reasons he brought God in there and told the workers was to cut off Sanballat, Tobiah, and all the nobles that followed them. And there's another group of adversaries that he didn't want to mess with in building the wall.
Yeah, and there's always people when you get involved in a project or doing something for the Lord that just aren't going to do it. They're going to be your naysayers. And sometimes we let that discourage us. Did that discourage Nehemiah? You know what? They didn't do it, but he just kept on going. He just kept on putting people around the wall, kept on making things work. So even those who wouldn't work didn't stop him. This can sometimes be a problem, but there are some people who do more work than others. If you read this in chapter 3, verses 11, 19, 21, 24, 27, and 30, Nehemiah talks about this group did this section of the wall, and they did another section of the wall. Now, what happens if you're in that group that's doing that sometimes? Who are you looking at? Everybody else who's not really pulling their weight like we're pulling our weight. And you never see that in this passage. Isn't that interesting? I'm sure Nehemiah must have had problems. But these folks were just doing the work, again, focusing on the glory of God, wanting to get the work done, doing all that they could. There were some people who started and did the work near their homes. There are others that, like we said, worked zealously and harder than others, but everybody did the work. And then, we'll just finish really quickly. How did they do the work? It's interesting, and if you read Wiersbe kind of gives you some interesting applications. I'm not sure they're all totally kosher. Maybe that's not a good word for it. They don't really apply necessarily, but some of them are interesting as I was reading through this. But there are some things that he makes mention of that help to kind of get a picture of what's going on. Look at Nehemiah 3 and verse 1 again. Nehemiah chapter 3 and verse 1 says, "And Eliashib the high priest rose with his brothers and the priests, and they built the sheep gate. And they consecrated it and set its doors. They consecrated it as far as the Tower of the Hundred and as far as the Tower of Hananel." So we've got this gate that they start out with, and they start out with the sheep gate. Anybody know anything about that sheep gate? Yeah.
That's where the sheep brought in for the slaughter of the temple.
Yeah, the sheep were brought in through there through the slaughtering of the temple. And the interesting thing, who's working on that gate?
The priests.
The priests are working on that gate. So Nehemiah puts the priests at the sheep gate. Why do you suppose he put the priests at the sheep gate instead of putting the priests down near the water gate or the priests at the horse gate? Yeah, because it was important to them. And not only did they put the sheep gate, the priests working at that gate, but what does it say they did to that gate halfway through that verse? They consecrated that gate. You could read through all these other, look at all the other gates around this city. And Nehemiah mentions them all. You know how many gates that he mentioned that they consecrated? One gate, the sheep gate, the place that the worship took place. Because again, as Nehemiah looked at all this project, somewhere between a mile and a half to 2.5 miles full of wall, Nehemiah's purpose again was the glory of God. And as he looked at that sheep gate and the worship that needed to be protected and reestablished around the temple right near that gate where all the sheep came in, that was a special project that they attempted to work on. From the sheep gate, so they went to the fish gate. So they went from the sheep gate, and then he talks about the fish gate. And what's important about the fish gate?
Where did they bring the fish in?
Yeah, probably where they brought the fish in, which is where it got its name. The market was probably near that gate, not too far away from that gate, down in through this area somewhere past the temple. And so you've got the fish gate there that they're working on. Then the old gate. Now, what did they do at the old gate? I was going to say that. You took my joke away. That's not what they did at the old gate. I don't know why they called it the old gate. That's not where all the senior citizens came in. But that is the old gate, and they started working on the old gate again. And you notice, as Nehemiah starts going through this chapter, where is he focusing the first part of the work? He could have started talking about anywhere in the city. Where does he start? Right in that Temple Mount area, because the glory of God is so important as he goes through there. We go from the that gate to verse 13, and he's got a group of people working at the Valley Gate. What do we know about the Valley Gate? Well, you got the Valley of Hinnom in there, no doubt about it. Remember anything about chapter 2 in the Valley Gate? That's the gate that Nehemiah came out that night and came down through here. The rubble was so bad in this area, he couldn't even get his mount through and had to go around and probably came up through this area and then back down and back in that gate. So that's where the vision all started taking shape as Nehemiah was coming through and planning that. It went down, and then he talks about the dung gate. And what was the purpose of the dung gate? Yeah, the refuge was all carried out. And again, this is where some of the applications I looked at thought, well, that's interesting and it sounds great, but I'm not sure it's really from the passage. But the fact that, what happens if the refuge isn't carried out of the city? And the refuge was carried out of the city, and what was done with it? It was burned in the Hinnom Valley. Now, when does that come up again? Yeah, he uses that as an allegory for hell, where the fire is never quenched. And the people could look out from the dung gate area and constantly see the glow of the fire of the trash. And Jesus Christ looked and he said, that's what hell is going to be like. That's why I have come to seek and to save that which was lost. And then we've got the fountain gate and the water gate with the springs that are all there. They worked on the armory. It says they worked on the oval gate there. The hot horse gate. What was the whole purpose of the horse gate? Or how did it get his name?
I have no idea.
And this is speculation again, so I have no idea. Maybe truer than what I read. But part of what I read was the horse gate partially got its name because during the time of Solomon, Solomon trusted in horses and went out. And God said, don't trust in horses, and he did anyway. And he brought in all these horses of war, and they believed that they were brought in and probably stabled somewhere in that region there, which is how the horse gate got its name. And then we go up further and we have the east gate. Do we know anything about the east gate that's worked on?
That's where Cross is going to enter when he returns.
What's the other name that we know that east gate as?
Golden.
It's also known as the Golden Gate. What do we know about that gate today?
It's sealed.
It's sealed shut. How did it get sealed shut? Anybody know that? Probably was. Yeah, I think it was the Ottomans that built that gate. Now, how did that gate get sealed up?
Sealed up in, what was it, 20s?
16th century. By the Turkish Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent. Sealed that up. Didn't want anybody else going through that gate. And it is sealed up, at least the gate as we know it today. Obviously, the other gate is lower than that. But that gate, as we know it today, is still sealed up. And what is the importance of it that we just discussed?
That's where Christ will be.
One day that gate will be open because Christ will enter into Jerusalem through that golden gate, through that gate that's still sealed up today. And then we go up here through the muster gate, and that probably had to do with the guards and the towers here where they guarded. And again, that's because that temple area was like a fortress area for the folks in Israel. But the interesting thing as we look through all that is, right at the end of the chapter in verse 32, Nehemiah comes back and he mentions one more time the sheep gate. Because the worship is first and foremost in his mind. The glory of God is first and foremost in all of his mind. And again, as you read through that, I encourage you to kind of glance through that. Anybody can read all the names and not stumble over any of them, I want to see you afterwards because I still got my tongue twisted from this week doing that. But the importance of that is, look how many people cooperated so that the work gets done. Now, was it easy? We're going to see in chapter 4 and 5. It wasn't an easy project to do, but the people rose up and they built because they had a mind to work for the glory of God. And that's one of the most first foremost things we can pull from that whole chapter. Let's pray. Father, we thank you again for the opportunity to look at the book of Nehemiah. And Lord, though some of it is a lot of details and a lot of names on who did what in the fixing, I pray that you'll help us to take from here some of the spiritual principles that are in here as well. The way that we need to work, the way that we need to focus, the way that you and your glory need to be first and foremost in our minds. May we live our lives in such a way that just as that city was there to glorify God, our lives are here to glorify God, that people may see our good works and be drawn to you and glorify the Father which is in heaven. For it's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.